BAI, New York, 99.5 FM. My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeople'sConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best and leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
It's a beautiful, sunny 82 degrees here in New York City. I'm Sri Srinivasan, host of Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. Today is our 11th show, and we're so grateful to everyone who's called in and to all our guests. Thank you for supporting WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-supported progressive radio here in New York City and worldwide on WBAI.org. On Coping with COVID-19, we discuss various aspects of the crisis, but focus on its effects on society's most vulnerable, the workers, the poor, the marginalized, and talk to ordinary citizens and experts. Let's learn together. A little bit about my background. I host daily shows about COVID-19 on my YouTube channel, SriNet, and I'm the Marshall Loeb Visiting Professor of Digital Innovation at Stony Brook University and someone who spent 25 years working at iconic New York City institutions. I was the Chief Digital Officer of Columbia, then the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then the city itself, working in the basement of City Hall. All three of those New York City icons, like millions of New Yorkers, have been disrupted as never before. A beloved city has become the U.S. epicenter of the crisis and the face of what can happen and what has already happened in so many other parts of the country. We're calling the show Helpful and Hopeful so that we can emerge stronger, and emerge we will. But we aren't just going to pretend everything is fine like someone we know in D.C. We're going to be clear-eyed and share factual, useful information and stories throughout the show. This past week, we've seen lots of anger in our nation, and for good reason. These protests have occurred all over the country in light of police brutality, specifically the murder of George Floyd. People are fed up, and we won't remain silent anymore. Hopefully, our show today can help us come to terms with everything we're dealing with in our country. Please call in and share your thoughts. 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, or email me, sree@sree.net, S-R-E-E at S-R-E-E.net. We have a two-hour show, and we have two fabulous guests. Not one, but two professors from Cornell. For our first hour, we have Professor Jamila Michener. She's an assistant professor at Cornell's Department of Government. She's got a book out now called Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics, which discusses the political landscape for Black, Latinx, and low-income Americans. For our second hour, we have Professor Nolwe Rooks of Cornell's Africana, American, and Feminist Studies programs. She's known for her public speaking and writing in some of America's top newspapers. She's also written a new award-winning book called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education, which discusses how America's segregated school system came to be the way it is. Now we start with Professor Jamila Michener. At Cornell's Department of Government, she has done research on poverty, racial inequality, and public policy in this country. Today she'll be with us to discuss the situation, and we are so grateful to have someone on who can educate and inform us and our listeners about what's happening, as well as answer any questions our callers may have. Hello, Professor. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on today.
We're very grateful that you would spend part of your Saturday with us. We start our show by asking every guest, how are you doing? How's your family?
Oh, thank you for asking. I am, I'm doing as well as I guess one could be doing in the middle of a major global health pandemic and also a major now global racial uprisings in response to racial injustice. There's a lot happening. My family as well, my immediate family is in upstate New York with me, my children, and my partner. And my extended family is actually, they're in New York City, in Queens, where I grew up. So they are holding on. I think that's what most of us are trying to do at this point.
I think holding on is as good as many of us can expect. I hope you had a chance to tell your family in Queens that you're on the radio right now, and I hope you'll text them while we're talking if you have a moment. We'd love for them to join us and listen to you, and maybe they could call in too, and they can catch us on 99.5 FM here in New York, but anywhere in the world on WBAI.org. Let's start with you. You mentioned two crises, right? I've been saying there are three pandemics or three crises happening: the healthcare crisis, the financial crisis, and the racial justice crisis. And all three are affecting African Americans and people of color disproportionately.
That's absolutely right. You know, the pandemic, the coronavirus, the COVID-19 crisis, which we've really been in the throes of since early March, is still raging. And I think because some time has passed and perhaps we're all getting exhausted, it's easy to feel like or to think and even to start to behave like it's over, but it's not. And as it unfolds, it's disproportionately affecting our urban communities, and in particular, urban communities of color, and we are still struggling with it and will be for some time until there's better treatment and until there's a vaccine. And there are still lives at risk and lives being altered and changed by it. And so it's something that we're going to be facing for some time now and going to have to get used to continually confronting for at least the next year. And so that's a challenge that we have to sort of keep our eye on, even as lots of other things are unfolding now around fighting racial justice. And those things are important and absolutely necessary as well. And so I think part of a challenge right now is how to balance fighting for public health, especially in communities of color, at the same time that we're fighting against racial violence and anti-Black violence, also especially in communities of color. And those fights are both interconnected and they're reconcilable. We can do those things at the same time, but that's hard to do, right?
Sorry, we lost you just in the last couple of seconds. If you could just repeat the very end, please.
Oh, I just said that fighting those things at the same time is hard. Those fights aren't irreconcilable. We can do them both at once.
And that's one of the things we learned from President Lincoln, right? That you could fight the Civil War and do other important landmark things at the same moment, then you can try to do it. But it's hard for individuals to do. It's one thing for the government to try to do that. We folks, you're listening to a conversation with Professor Jamila Michener. She's at Poverty Scholar at Cornell's American Studies Department, and she's a professor of government there. Let's start with your Twitter handle. Tell us how you came across that and the fact that you were able to get it says you were on it early.
You know, I for a long time really avoided Twitter, but I didn't understand how it worked, and I thought it was like Facebook. So I thought that in order to see what other people were doing, you had to be on there too. And so what I wanted to do was just lurk and look at other people's tweets. But because I didn't understand how it worked, I thought in order to lurk, I had to start my own handle. So probably back in, I think it was 2009 or so, I thought, let me start a Twitter account so that I can look at other people's Twitter accounts. And at the time, it might have even been later than that. I don't remember the exact year now, but at the time, I thought, I don't know what I want my Twitter handle to be, but I knew it was a space where I wanted to talk about the things that I study, and I study poverty, and I study racial inequality. And so I thought, well, let me just see. I'm a scholar, and I study poverty. Let me just see if I can use that one. And I was lucky enough that it was available. And for the first few years after I joined Twitter, I hardly tweeted a thing, because I really just wanted to see what other people were doing. I didn't trust that venue as a place where I could have a voice that was both safe, where I wouldn't get pounced on, and valuable. I didn't think it mattered very much. But it was really about 3 years ago that I started to get more serious about tweeting, and I think it was largely because I needed a venue for saying how I felt about what was happening in the world. And so now it's a venue that I really appreciate and value, but it's taken me quite a number of years to get there. And the handle I just stumbled on, honestly, in ignorance, I happened to find it.
And you've obviously found your voice there as well. You obviously have a scholarly voice, and you publish books and things like that, but you found your Twitter voice, and we're so grateful that you have. I see you just shouted out Daniel Gillian, who's joined Twitter. So now there you are, welcoming other people onto Twitter.
Yeah. I think Twitter can be a hellscape if you get looped into the wrong communities, and it's someplace that can perpetrate a lot of harm, right? But it's also someplace where you can engage faithfully, you can share information. There's a lot of opportunity for education and for informing people. And I think at base, I am a scholar and I want to teach. I want to teach my students at Cornell, of course, but I also want to teach more broadly than that. And I want my teaching to be democratic, not just to benefit the people who can get an education at Cornell, but others as well. That's why I teach in prison, because I think those folks deserve access to education as well. And that's the reason for speaking publicly, because you want to be able to engage and learn yourself and help others learn in a way that goes beyond the confines of an academic institution.
And that's one of the ways that people have found the value in it. And so I encourage all of you to follow Poverty Scholar on Twitter. Let's talk about what's happening today. Where were you when you first saw that video of George Floyd, and how did you feel, react to that moment?
I have to confess that I never watched the full video. I made a decision years ago that I would not watch videos of Black people being murdered, both for my own mental health, because after watching a number of those videos, in 2014 and 2015, I realized that they affected me in a really profound way, that it was hard for me to shake. It was hard for me to sleep. It was hard for me to focus after I had watched those videos. And I realized that they were compounding trauma in my own life. And so I have not watched the full video. I heard about George Floyd, I think, pretty quickly after what happened last week on Wednesday. and I saw a short clip of the video unwittingly. I wasn't trying to watch it. I was trying to read about the story, and I pressed the page, and the video began to play. I stopped it almost immediately. And what I've done is I've read as much about it as possible, but actually watching the physical video, I haven't done, and quite intentionally. I think that I'm worried about videos like that. First of all, being frequent enough that we become desensitized to them. And in many ways, that desensitization can amplify a problem that has long been a problem, which is the dehumanization of black people. Because who else do we see constantly on video being murdered? I think people call it trauma porn. And I don't know that I love that term, but I think it does get something across, which is that it's almost, it's dramatic and it's big and it grabs people. And they become reliant on that kind of a stimulus in order to feel like something is really wrong. And I don't think that we should need videos of black people being murdered to spark our outrage. Obviously, in this case, it has happened. And hopefully, I think it is doing something good right now and something necessary that's going to sparking action and reaction that is going to get us to a place of change. That's what I'm hoping for. But I also hope we get to the point where we don't need to see black people being brutally murdered on video in order to grapple with the deep injustices that we've faced in American life forever, literally since before the United States of America was the United States of America.
Thank you, Professor Michener. We're listening to Jamila Michener, professor at Cornell. And she is the author of a new book that you will all want to know about because it is covering new aspects of something that we have been familiar with. But the title is Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics, which discusses the political landscape for Black, Latinx, and low-income Americans. We will talk more about the book and get back to her in just a minute. We want to make sure that you get to speak to her. You're listening to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. And I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan. Tweet us at Sri, S-R-E-E, at W-B-A-I, and the hashtag W-B-A-I-Sri. Or call us, please, at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, and we'll bring you on the air in just a few minutes. Professor, tell us about your book and how you came to focus on this aspect of your work.
Sure. My book focuses on poverty and inequality through the lens of Medicaid, which is our nation's healthcare program that specifically is designed to provide health insurance for people who are living in or near poverty. And so I try to think about what kinds of experiences people who are living in or near poverty, and a disproportionate share of those people are Black and Latino. I try to think about what kinds of experiences they have with this program, with Medicaid, and how that affects them, both in terms of their health, but also in terms of their political lives, right? How we have only so many opportunities to interact with the government. And for people who rely on the government for health care, that is a major point of interaction. What does that mean for how people engage the government, for the kinds of ideas they get about whether they matter as denizens of a political community, and for how they enact their kind of place in democracy, how they behave politically? And so that's what the book really delves into. I ended up kind of, again, stumbling into the topic. I guess I stumble into things. I knew that I wanted to, I've always known since I decided to kind of get my PhD and be a scholar what I cared about. And I've always known that that was poverty and inequality and racial inequality. And so when I went to graduate school, I was really just trying to think about what specific lens I would study those things through. And I care a lot about public policy because it's the concrete mechanism through which people's lives can be affected and changed. And I knew I wanted to study some public policy, and I wanted to think about how people living in poverty engage that policy and what it meant for their lives. But I didn't know the details, and I started talking to people. I decided instead of just making up a topic off of the top of my head or reading books that other scholars had written and just responding to them, that I would try to actually go and talk to real people, figure out what was happening in their lives, and write about something that was responsive to their sense of priorities and their experiences. And I started talking to people on the south and west sides of Chicago, which is where I lived at the time, about what mattered to them, about how the government was affecting their lives. That was probably around 2010. And so for understandable reasons, it was right at the time that the Affordable Care Act was emerging. A lot of people were talking about healthcare and brought up Medicaid. So I realized that Medicaid really mattered in the lives of people who were living in poverty. And because it mattered to them, it mattered to me. So I decided to study it, and that ultimately led to me writing a book about it.
And that book has gotten very good reviews, and people really have seen that it can shine a really important light on this topic. It won the Virginia Gray Best Book Award, American Political Science Association. And let me just read this comment from Vesla May Weave. Michael Bloomberg, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Sociology at Johns Hopkins, called it an extraordinary achievement. The message takes on urgent importance in our time, pushing us to reimagine the policy at the local, state, and national levels. What is your prescription? If you could be the czar of Medicaid, what would you do?
Well, you know, it's in an odd way, I guess it's ironic. I mean, if I was in the position of being a czar and could do anything, what I would do was probably make Medicaid unnecessary by creating a more universal system where everyone had access to health care that was not tethered to their employment, not tethered to the labor market, and that was free and fair and equitable and robust. And so Medicaid beneficiaries then would no longer be Medicaid beneficiaries. They would just be people in this country able to access health care irrespective of their wealth, their social status, their race, their medical conditions. And obviously that would be a huge lift, and that would be a hard system to achieve politically. And it would also be challenging in terms of cost and in terms of a bureaucratic list, and there's a lot of things there. So that's not terribly realistic, but it's what I would do if I could do anything. I think given the constraints of the present moment and given the structure of our healthcare system as it is now, I think the next kind of most realistic best thing for me is to strengthen Medicaid, make it a program that's more robust, both in terms of funding and but also to really think about how people are treated in these programs and think about the ways that messages about your dignity, your worth, and your value as a political agent are conveyed in these programs. And there are a lot of nuts and bolts things that we could change about the way that Medicaid is administered, the way that it's on the front lines coming into people's lives, how they're experiencing it as they engage with bureaucrats and as they go into agencies and as they renew their applications and as they enroll in the program, and even as they pursue the actual benefits and services that come with the program. There are a ton of details in there, but the overarching change across all of those details that I would sort of most want is to design every aspect of the program administration with kind of human dignity in mind so that people are treated in a way that reinforces their membership in social and political communities and that draws them into our democracy. You know, through a program like Medicaid, we can give people access to health care, and that is crucial, but we can also give people better access to our democracy, to our polity. And that's just as crucial, right? And in fact, the two are related. A more robust democracy means that people are going to be positioned to make demands of the government to continue to do what's best for people, for ordinary people. So I guess that's what I would change, although, you know, it's a lot harder than it sounds in reality.
May I ask you, was there a moment when the American healthcare system could have turned out differently, where we don't have the worst outcomes, where we don't have people who have to go into poverty because they get sick? It doesn't happen in any other developed country in the world. And even some less developed countries have better care for their people than we do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there have been a couple of inflection points where things could have gone in different directions. I think certainly in the wake of the Great Depression, at the kind of emergence of the New Deal, when there was more than there had really ever been before that point, a level of kind of openness to the idea of the government intervening in a major way into people's lives in order to sort of protect them from the excesses of the market and ensure some basic floor of rights that would secure human dignity, right? And healthcare being foremost among those. There was a moment there for the New Deal to also include kind of not just access to the resources that would provide people with economic support, but also to health resources. It would have been difficult and a heavy lift, and because of where our country was at that time with respect to continued official kind of state sanctioned, racism, right? It would have been flawed and problematic if it had emerged at that point, for sure. But it was an inflection point where we could have gone a lot farther with respect to advancing the cause of universal health care. I think that there was another inflection point in the 1940s, you know, in the early 1940s, when Americans were surveyed about their opinions on universal health care, we had 75% of the populace saying that they wanted it, right? And we had President Truman, who was on board and who actually had a kind of national campaign intended to sort of pressure Congress into sending him a bill that would produce something like universal health care and that would provide an avenue for better access to health care for more Americans. Again, it was the 1940s, so whatever would have been produced at that time would have been more than likely really problematic with respect to how it was distributed along racial lines. But it was an inflection point where more could have happened. I think we had another, again, in the 1960s with the emergence of the Great Society. And then probably another in 2010 with the Affordable Care Act. At every point where we've had major turning points, either specifically with respect to health policy or more broadly with respect to economic policy, there were opportunities and even particular proposals on the table to do more, to push further. And each of those were missed. And they were often missed because of the involvement of kind of special interests, we might think of them, both with respect to interests representing wealthy doctors who didn't see it as being in their best interest to have a more universal system that involved public coverage, and with respect to groups like, for example, white segregationists in the South who didn't want the government to be able to have a larger role in healthcare that it would then use to force them to desegregate or force them to be more racially progressive. So there are these various interests throughout history that have stalled a more universal approach to healthcare, and usually those interests have been thinking about what benefits economic and racial elites and have blockaded the push towards universal health care due to a desire to protect what was best for people who are at the kind of top of the economic and racial hierarchies.
Folks, you're listening to Professor Jamila Michener of Cornell University, and we're talking on the issue of Medicaid and also trying to understand the healthcare system in this country. We're now going to take one of our callers. You're on the air on WBAI. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Alan Williams, Menelik the III. I'm from Brooklyn. I just want to clarify certain things because I realize, and I applaud the lady for writing this book because it's been constantly on the airways. They give the majority of the people that have died from COVID, but they do not emphasize how many people have died, and mostly black people in the northeast section of the United States. And I find that to be somewhat genocidal in nature. Of course, then the history of black people in the United States of America go back to slavery, and they always have used the black man or black people as marginalized footballs politically, and politically footballs being tossed around at will to serve a cause. Black people have been marginalized in all aspects of American life. We have not been denied our freedom. We've been denied health care. We've been denied economic priority. We've been denied educational priority. We don't know of it. There's a book that was written back in 1951 by William L. Patterson. It's called We Charge Genocide. And in the book, it describes how black people have been living in the United States, and that there was an overwhelming percentage of police brutality done during when I was born. I was born in 1948. From 1945 after World War II, all the way up to 1954, they have documents of black people being beat down by police in the South, but nobody emphasized that. And there's the book is called We Charge Genocide by William L. Patterson and Paul Robeson. They presented this petition to the United Nations in 1951, and it did not get any kind of applause. Our people, this petition was against the United States government as a conspiracy against black people in the United States. Ever since we were brought over here as federal property for the institution of slavery, and people profited off of that, and they still profited off of it.
Thank you, caller. We appreciate you calling in. Professor Michener, your thoughts?
I think, I a lot of those points are precisely right. I appreciate that the caller pointed out that the kind of racial oppression that in particular black people have faced in this country has transcended all areas of life, right? And so I focus on healthcare, and that's one key area, but it's also happening with respect to policing and black communities' relationship with the police state. And it's also happening with respect to economic life and black people's ability to access the resources and the opportunities that will allow them economic mobility. And it's also happening with respect to this pandemic, as the caller so crucially pointed out, right? There's some really sobering data on the COVID-19 pandemic that suggests that the kind of disparities, you know, that suggest the concrete reality of these disparities, right? So part of what the data suggests is even if we think about how many black people would still be alive if black people were dying from COVID-19 at rates that were similar to the rates that that white people are dying from it, and estimates put that number at approaching 14,000 right now. So we're talking about 14,000 lives, people who have families, people who have communities, are gone on account of disparities that are rooted not in particular health behaviors or lifestyle choices, but in enduring patterns of institutional racism across a range of different institutions that lead to these kinds of outcomes, so that when a pandemic emerges, it's not an equal opportunity pandemic. It's a pandemic that is particularly targeting Black communities. And so I think, you know, I think that the caller made a lot of really good points and is trying to sort of integrate these different areas and connect dots that are worth connecting.
Thank you, Professor. And folks, you can still dial in at 212-209-2877 and talk to Professor Jamila Michener. I'm looking at today's New York Times, Professor, and the lead story is jobless rate dips, defying outlook, U.S. stock surge. And we also see virus closures leave students falling behind. Gaps of race and class are likely to widen. There are stories on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about how even as the job gains have improved, you know, what happened yesterday, the numbers were a little bit better, and the unemployment of Black folks went up in this moment instead of going down. Even as overall unemployment fell, it ticked up for Black folks. And when President Trump was asked yesterday, what are you doing for African Americans and other people in this time of racial oppression and police brutality, he said, the economy is going to fix it. That's his plan. The economy is his plan. Is that a plan at all? When we hear that America was doing so great before the virus, African Americans and others were still suffering. Yes, the unemployment rate may have been at an all-time low among Blacks and Latinos, but that doesn't mean people weren't working two or three jobs just to have a job. Didn't mean that people weren't dropping out of looking for work. Can you talk about some of those factors, please?
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that that fixing the economy or saving the economy is somehow going to also save Black people or alleviate the problems that are being faced and have been faced in the Black community right now is a false logic, but it's a logic that persists and that continues to be popular, particularly among those who don't want to, in good faith, fashion solutions that are going to more directly address the sources of racial inequality. I think this idea that a rising tide lifts all boats, and if we can just rise the tide, improve the economy, everybody will benefit, has proven untrue again and again and again, right? And instead, when the economy grows, the benefits of that growth accrue disproportionately. So who is benefiting the most? First of all, the people who are at the top economically, which we know is not, tends not to be Black and brown people. And so just because the economy is growing and the pie is expanding, it doesn't mean that Black people are going to be better off. If the expansion just means that the people who already have large slices of the pie are going to get even larger slices, and that the people who have small slices will likely continue getting small slices or maybe get the pie taken away from them altogether. I think that we've known for a long time that when we see unemployment numbers, we have to take them into context, because white unemployment and Black unemployment tend to look dramatically different. Black unemployment is consistently at least twice as high as white unemployment, and that's when things are good. That gulf grows even more dramatically during times of recession or other kinds of struggle. And I think it is absolutely true and proven by empirical evidence that even increasing economic opportunity more broadly does not necessarily mean increased opportunities for people of color, in particular Black people. Part of that is because racial discrimination in the labor market, especially the low-wage labor market, is still rampant. And every time social scientists look to measure it, they find it. And the most recent meta study that looks at, you know, hiring discrimination and all of the different hiring discrimination studies that have been done over the last two decades, what it finds is that the problem isn't getting any better. So there's no reason to believe that by creating more jobs, we're necessarily creating opportunities for Black people, because they get discriminated against in the labor market. And even when they're able to get jobs, end up getting jobs that we can, that you know, economists and other social scientists consider them being underemployed, right? So you're working part-time, you're working for lower wages, you're working for fewer benefits. You may have to work more jobs in order to get the same amount that a white person is getting. You might have to work two jobs, right? And you may never be able to reach that level, no matter how hard you work. And so I think that this idea that we're just going to take care of everyone and somehow that will also take care of Black people along the way is not true. But what it is an easy way out. I don't actually have to think about the root of racial inequality. I can just say I'm going to help everyone, and under the cover of that, do nothing about racial disparities. And that's essentially what the president is doing when he says the solution is the economy. You may as well say, I have no solution for that, and I don't even care to fashion one.
How do you wrestle with the fact that he seems to have gotten the attention of some African-American leaders and others who are kind of portraying him as someone who has the interest of the African-American community? He's plural, right? There's no such thing as one community at heart.
Yeah. I think that's hard. I mean, in some way, the answer was in the question, and I'm so glad that you emphasized African-American communities, right? Because the fact that some people understand or interpret the president's intentions as, you know, as benign towards Black communities is only explained by just the heterogeneity in interpretation and in understanding of what indicates intention, you know? Any and everyone will say with their words that they're interested in, at least any politician that wants to have a future, is going to at least be able to gesture verbally towards caring about, you know, Black communities, towards wanting to help them, and towards having goodwill for them. So it's not surprising that even a president like President Trump will gesture towards those things verbally, right? Will bring, you know, Black folks into the White House who supposedly represent some sort of effort to, you know, show goodwill towards Black communities. I think as a scholar of public policy, for me, at the end of the day, it really comes down to material realities more so than symbolic politics. I don't care how many Black people are invited to the White House. I don't care how many speeches say such and such thing about goodwill towards Black communities. What matters is, what are you doing concretely? And if we look at this president's approach to social policy, for example, the policies that are important in Black communities, like Medicaid, right, like supplemental nutrition assistance policies, like legal services that provide Black communities with support in the context, for example, of getting evicted because we're in the middle of an eviction crisis, like fill in the blank. I can keep going. We can look at virtually any policy realm that is about providing concrete material benefits, and particularly to communities of color. And this president fails on all of those metrics. The administration has consistently been focused on retrenchment in all of those areas, taking things away, providing fewer benefits, providing fewer resources, making it harder to get to those resources, erecting barriers. And so if you're saying, I want to help Black people, but what you're doing at every turn is taking resources away from those communities, then it doesn't much matter to me what your intentions are. It doesn't matter what's in your heart and mind. It doesn't matter whether you have a racist bone in your body, according to you or others. I mean, it doesn't matter how many black people you surround yourself with. What matters is what you're actually doing for communities. There's a record. This president has a record. We don't have to take his word for it.
And of course, it doesn't mean just because Kanye is there that he has good judgment.
Oh my gosh. I guess that goes without saying. It's not clear whether he's aware of this president's record on the concrete issues or whether he's even aware of the reality of that. And this is where, you know, the intersection between race and class really matter. Somebody who is economically very, very comfortable and at a point where they're so distant from the stuff of the everyday lives of, you know, struggling working class black and brown people doesn't really get to be the representative for black communities and can live their life without really understanding what's going on in those communities. And this desire to pick some high profile black person and sort of tokenize them and make them the voice or the representation for the black community or for black communities, that is a problem, right? And it can mislead us into thinking, well, if Kanye's there, then maybe he's not so bad. When in fact, that has almost no relevance to the concrete matters at hand that affect what's happening in people's everyday lives.
Can you comment on the prison reform work that has happened in this administration and why it didn't happen before and how much credit should Trump get for that?
I think that a couple of things. One is I think that the prison reform work that's happened in this administration has been consistent with a pattern that we've seen developing over at least the last, I would say, 7 to 10 years, which is a turn away from, it will be really interesting to see how this present moment affects this. But there has been an ongoing and to some extent bipartisan turn away from kind of quote-unquote mass incarceration, right? I think largely because of the work of black activists and largely because of the work of grassroots community groups and also of kind of black cultural producers and thinkers, people like Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, which is a book that isn't perfect, but absolutely gained national attention and got people thinking about the problem with the criminal legal system and with mass incarceration. Black cultural producers like Ava DuVernay, who produced the documentary The 13th, that again captured national attention and got people thinking about what we were doing by putting mass numbers of black and brown people in cages and where that came from historically and what it reflected about our nation. We've gotten to a point where it just made us look terrible, right? To have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners and to have this reputation as a kind of carceral juggernaut, right? And it was extremely expensive. We were and still are spending billions and billions of dollars to lock people in cages. And not just any people, but large swaths of poor black and brown people. And so that practice has become a liability that both folks on the left and the right can recognize as such, right? Now, that's not to make false equivalencies. The reasons for wanting to change that system are different depending on which side of the political aisle you're coming from. And the extent of change that you want is different. But there has been bipartisan agreement on the fact that the criminal justice system needs to be, or criminal legal system, I don't like to say justice because that's not what's generally being doled out, but that the criminal legal system needs to change is something that everyone agreed on. So some of the kind of high-profile salient changes that the Trump administration has been behind were easy. They didn't require political sacrifice because everyone was still on board with them. You know, the question is what kinds of changes are going to be made when we get to the hard stuff, And now as we enter into a conversation about defunding the police, less resources to the police state, more resources that go, that are funneled into communities for things that are going to build those communities and not break them down, right? When we talk about things like removing the immunities and protections that police have so that they can be held accountable to their behaviors. And when we talk about things like really fundamentally changing not just policing systems, but carceral systems in this country, right? So that the ways in which those systems are have allowed people to sort of profiteer, private corporations to make profits off of keeping people in cages. I mean, there are hard questions that are in front of us. And so I think that the Trump administration has really picked the low-hanging fruit and then expected us to be super grateful that for even that. And look, every policy that makes people's lives better, I'm a fan of. But at the end of the day, picking the low-hanging fruit isn't enough. We need to orient towards what transformational change of the system looks like. And that's not something that this administration has indicated any willingness to think about.
Sharing that, we want to tell everyone that you also do a lot of work with prisons yourself. You're on the advisory board of the Cornell Prison Education Program, and you teach in local prisons. What is the Cornell Prison Education Program?
Cornell has a prison education program that is in recognition of and response to the fact that a lot of prisons are located upstate, and Cornell is upstate. And within an hour from Cornell, there are four or five different prisons, three that are maximum security, several that are medium security. There's a juvenile correction facility that's not 10 minutes away from my house. And a lot of the people who are filling these correctional institutions are indeed black and brown people from downstate. They're being sent from New York City or sometimes other cities around the state where there are significant populations of racial minorities. They're coming from Rochester. They're coming from Buffalo. And they're being sent to the areas that surround Cornell. So Cornell is in a unique position to play a role in engaging those institutions in a productive way. And that's what the prison education program is about. It's about going into these local prisons and providing the people there who are people with educational opportunities. And so what faculty who volunteer for the prison education program, faculty volunteer their time. It doesn't sort of count as our regular teaching that we do on campus. We don't get paid for it. We volunteer our time. We go into local prisons and we teach. I actually teach the exact same courses that I teach on campus. And we work with a local community college, Cayuga, and the students who take our courses in prison are able to, because these are kind of accredited courses that are taught at the same level that they're taught on campus, these students, they're able to have a transcript. They're able to get for these classes to count towards their credits, towards an associate's degree, which they can get while they're in prison. And when they're released, they can use those credits towards courses at CUNY and SUNY institutions across New York State so that they're able to get their bachelor's degrees. And it's an important mechanism for democratizing access to education. Many of the people who are sitting in prison are people who have been deprived of opportunities for quality education. And why shouldn't an institution like Cornell use its resources and wherewithal to reverse that state of affairs? And to provide the very people who many institutions essentially have forgotten and left behind with opportunities to learn and to grow in their knowledge of the world and of themselves.
You studied, Professor, you got your PhD at the University of Chicago, not in the economics department, but the economics department, of course, is very famous for having, let's say, a conservative bent. How did it feel to be in that environment, and how did that help you understand the work you're doing?
You know, a lot of people, the University of Chicago's motto, I don't think it's the official motto, but at least unofficial, is the University of Chicago, where fun comes to die. And I would say that that is largely true in the sense that it's an intense place where people are serious about learning and where, as you pointed out, there's a certain degree of kind of ideological, there's a kind of ideological spectrum. So you're going to encounter, for me, I encounter people who thought very differently from me. But I am by and large grateful for my education there, in large part because of the faculty in the political science department that I worked with directly. And I was able to have mentors who were black scholars who were brilliant academically, but also deeply engaged in the world beyond the academic realm. And so my main advisor when I was at the University of Chicago, Kathy J. Cohen, was not only a brilliant scholar, which she was, but a committed activist who did a lot in the world besides just scholarship. And being able to have that example, especially an example of a black woman doing it, for me as also as a black woman, was so crucial and really motivated and inspired me in a way that I think would have been hard for me to find elsewhere. And so I'm grateful to have been trained by people who care about the academic credentials and research, but also care about the world in a much deeper way. And that doesn't that's not what you would think about when you think about the University of Chicago, especially through the lens of the econ department. But at least I was able, while there, to have access to a different kind of education that positioned me to be a public scholar and to do things like the kind of work that I do in prison, which, you know, a lot of people are like, well, why do that work? You know, that's outside of the kind of bounds of what we might expect from an ivory tower or Ivy League academic. But I was trained in a context where we were always being pushed to think about our work beyond the walls of academia and to think about how we could bring that work into the lives of the people who are on the margins to make their lives better.
Well, that is a wonderful way to think about your career and your work. And, you know, we have your colleague, Nolowe Rooks, joining us in the next hour.
She's going to be wonderful.
We would
She's
love to.
She's going to be wonderful.
Yeah. No, do you want to stick around and just say hello to her on the air, and then we can say goodbye to you. Is that okay?
Perfect. Perfect.
Okay. So we're now going to take a break on coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. And you've been listening to Professor Jamila Michener. We're going to say goodbye to her properly when we say hello to our colleague, Professor Nolowe Rooks, who's going to join us just at the top of the hour. Folks, thank you so much for listening, everybody, and stay tuned. We're going to come right back, and we're going to take you to Stand By Me.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by. As long as you stand by.
old buddy, old pal.
So I want you to be my buddy.
Friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan, on WBAI 99.5 FM and worldwide on WBAI.org. Please call us at 212-209-2877. We want to hear from you, and we want to put you on the air with our guests. In the past hour, you've been listening to a conversation with Professor Jamila Michener of Cornell, and we still have her with us for a couple more minutes. Hello, Professor.
Hello.
Thanks for being here. And we're also joined by Professor Noliwe Rooks, who is the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature. And she is an interdisciplinary scholar of Africana, American, and Feminist Studies program. She's known for her public speaking and writing in some of America's top newspapers. And she's written a new award-winning book, Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education, which discusses how America's segregated school system came to be this way. We thought it would be fun for the two of you just to say hello to each other on the air before we let Jamila go.
Hey, Sister Scholar.
Hey, I want to say that you all have some brilliant insights coming your way. That's guaranteed. Insights that I was able to benefit from the time I was an undergraduate at Princeton through now, I have been learning from Professor Rook, so I'm glad you all will be able to learn from her as well.
Have you both been in a meeting yet since school closed, or when was the last time you were together in the same room?
When was the last time I even laid eyes on you, Jamila? I don't know.
Probably
walking across campus.
Yep, across the quad in the fall. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's been a while.
Like, you know, Jamil is busy.
Me,
You're busy. I keep up with you online and do your speaking and stuff. I'm a complete fan, but we don't really get to see each other as much as one would think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the things that people don't understand about big universities, right? They are big and people are busy and everyone has their own things to do. Even with their friends, they don't get to see them as much. And now in this new post-COVID world, we're not even sure what's going to happen. In terms of classes, has Cornell announced what they're doing in the fall? I'll ask each of you that.
No, well, there've been no official announcements. From what I understand, like everybody, I mean, I think Cornell statements and movement to date seems to be like others, that it is, we're going to try to bring students back and, you know, institute different hygiene and distance protocols to keep everybody safe, and a lot of the classes will be online. That's what I'm hearing. What about you, Jamila?
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well, but no official decisions, and I'm getting the feeling that we'll have a lot of autonomy in deciding whether or not we want to teach on campus or online, and based on what we feel safe doing, et cetera. So I think there are still a lot of details to be worked out, and it's going to be a crazy fall.
And we hope you both have some time for the summer to spend with your families. We know how difficult the spring has been for everybody. Before we get let Jamila go, Professor Rooks, if you have anything you'd like to ask her, on a really tough question, if you want to ask her, there's a good chance to do so.
Yes, so Jamila, what's the one thing, like, you know, as we are, this is not even COVID, this is just this moment, as we're in this moment of real change where we're seeing some possibility of things coming to fruition, at least the possibility of it, what's the one thing that you're most hopeful about coming out of the other side of this, of the these pandemics of police violence as well as public health? Like, what's the one thing that you'd be like, this looks like victory to me?
Oh, man, that is a hard question. I'm not surprised, but it's a good one. A lot of times people ask me what the one thing I would change is, which I think is extremely hard. But don't point me towards optimism by asking me what the one thing I'm hopeful about is. So I appreciate, there's a wisdom in that I really appreciate. I guess, you know, the thing that I'm hopeful about is that there's a body of research that suggests that protests, violent and nonviolent, and the uprisings that we're seeing now do matter and do change things, not only in terms of concrete policies, but in terms of the way that people think about what's happening. And so the thing that is hopeful to me is, even though in the details of it, it's often frustrating, but a renewed conversation around institutional racism, anti-blackness, and how that affects so many different areas of life. I think the dual, the confluence of a public health crisis marked by deep racial disparities and a political crisis sparked by anti-black racial violence forces people to think about these things across domains and to confront some of the core problems in a way that I don't think they've been forced to do for a long time. And especially in the wake of Obama and the sense that we had somehow reached a post-racial nirvana, which was never true, but people were willing to at least try to believe for the sense of their own comfort, that has now been thrown out of the window. And there's a renewed necessity to actually confront racism and anti-blackness, and that gives me hope, even if that hope is extremely measured. It gives me some hope.
And Professor Jamila Michener, you now have a chance to ask Professor Rook something.
Oh, this is so fun. See, look, I thought I was getting off just asking the question.
That's what I thought too. I guess I would ask Professor Rook, this is easy, I would ask her the same thing she asked me, where she sees hope, if any, because I struggle with hope. It's not something that I always have a lot of, at least not when it comes to these issues. So I'd love to see what her sources of hope
are. Yeah, right. Well, the world has not given us a whole lot of reason to believe that these moments of eruption actually are going to lead to wholesale change, you know, like that. So that is why I think we struggle with it. I think the thing that I found in the last week or so, I find myself open mouthed, at some of the responses in a good way, to this moment. So to have the NFL jump out and start talking about we were wrong and uttering the words, you know, black lives. What that represents to me is not Roger Goodell having some sort of come to Jesus moment. What it represents to me is what has been happening behind the scenes, what black players have been doing, the organizing that's taking place off stage that leads to a moment, right? Like that moment of affirmation and apology. I don't believe was some evangelical thing, right? Like he's just sitting around in bed at night and went, hey, black lives do matter, right? things were taking place off the screen. And I keep hearing in companies and in corporations and in institutions similar stories where groups of black young people or just black people are really bringing pressure to bear about, but what are you going to change? What are you going to do? And that is incredibly hopeful to me, because I think that those kinds of institutional spaces, when people that are a part of those institutions get an audience with those in power and are forthright and strident and clear enough, and their resolve is such that it begins to move the needle. But we may never know what happened. We may never hear those conversations. But I'm hearing more from folks who are involved in them in ways that really do make that tell me once again that organizing does matter. You know, like organizing, getting in the streets, it really makes a difference. Today in New York City, I was saying the only protest, I'm scared of COVID still, right? Like I'm like, yes. I'm all about black freedom, but I am of a age and disposition I'm scared of the virus. So, but the only protest I have recently thought about literally putting on a mask and going to, if I was in New York, I'm up in Ithaca, is the one taking place today to get police out of schools. In New York City, you know, you have thousands of people who have shown up to say, get them out. This is a moment where you can imagine someone listening, right? Like, so all of that pressure that has been brought to bear and is asking for tangible change. We get to kneel in protest, in peaceful protest at an NFL game. It may seem small, but looking at what it took to get to that, you know, it's not small.
Yeah.
That you can have students and teachers identify the presence that a lot of wealthy communities don't even know this happens, but identify the presence of police in their schools as something we now can organize and change. That's hopeful. That's big.
Absolutely.
To me. And that's something that you can imagine happening. So it's not like we're all going to end racism forever. Yeah, okay. No, but you know, I mean, maybe. Look, I'm willing to whatever. But yeah, we will not have police in schools with our babies. We will not have grown men told what to do with their bodies in public, right? That's for me hopeful.
Well, this has been amazing. I'm going to step out of here, so you two please just carry on with the show, because this is so fabulous. And
look, we clearly got a lot to say to each other. We don't talk to each other enough. Jamila is amazing, though. I have known her since she was an undergrad, and not all undergrads hit you in a way that you know they're going to make their people proud. Let me put it like that. Not every undergraduate you meet are you like, boy, their family is going to have a lot to celebrate from this life. And Jamila has been and continues to grow and find her footing and her voice with her commitments intact. And most people in and around higher education, especially these rarefied institutions, will tell you coming out the other side sane is one thing, but coming out with your commitment to the folks you grew up with, to the folks who raised you, to the communities that look like you, it is no small thing. And she's done that, and she has done that beautifully. So it's a pleasure.
Oh, my God.
It's a pleasure.
That makes me want to cry. And I will say that that's only possible when you have models of possibility. And for me, Noliwe was a possibility model. I remember sitting in her class as an undergraduate, and it, like, we were learning and talking about, like, black women's hair. And I did not imagine there was a world possible where I could think about that, learn about it, talk about it, and it would be considered a valid subject of academic inquiry, and the person in front of the room teaching me about it would look like me and would be a black woman who was confident and brilliant. So just to see that possibility modeled is so crucial to enabling you to have any sense that it's something that you could do. And so whatever –
I am is hinges on no leeway and folks like her being what it is they are. And so, anyway, I don't want to keep taking up her time, but I just want to say I love this. This is like a full circle moment, and her brilliance has benefited me and will benefit everyone who listens today.
Thank you so much, Professor Jamila Michener. She's the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Everyone, please get that book, and also please follow her on Twitter. She's at Poverty Scholar. Thank you for that extended period of time with us. I feel blessed to have eavesdropped on this conversation. And thank you and goodbye while we continue our conversation with Professor Nolwey Rooks. How was that? That was pretty cool, huh?
That was pretty cool. Look, I am grateful that you gave me the chance to shout out Jamila, you know? Like, I don't get to see her enough to do it.
One of the things, of course, that people presume let's start by saying there aren't always enough people of color at the major universities, but they always presume everybody's hanging out because there are so few. And that this tells you that we all have our own paths. And, I was a professor at Columbia for 20 years in journalism, and people presumed I knew every one of the other Indian professors on campus. I know of them. I'd admire them. But we all have our own lives, right?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like when you live in L.A., I'm from San Francisco, the other part of California, but I hear some people live in L.A. Everybody expects that you're seeing celebrities all the time, you know, that like surely as you just stroll through the supermarket, you are seeing celebrities and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you're just not, but it's kind of similar.
But you both are celebrities on campus, and so we're so glad to have you both. Now, let me give you the introduction that you deserve, because we got right into that conversation. Let me remind everyone, you're listening to a conversation as part of Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. Obviously, in this moment, we are facing three pandemics, the pandemic of COVID-19, the pandemic of financial crises, and we're facing the pandemic of police violence. And the stunning thing to me is at a moment when all police are being watched extra carefully, when they know they're on camera, there are now more assaults taking place against the protesters. So the confidence of these people to continue to do that is especially galling. And we'll talk about that and many other issues. Let me tell you about Professor Rooks. She is, first of all, has one of the greatest titles in American academia. She is the W.E.B. Du Bois professor at the university, at Cornell University, which is a very special title. And we'll talk about the legacy of that, being a professor of literature. She's an interdisciplinary scholar of Africana, American, and feminist studies. And her new book is called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education, which discusses how America's segregated school system came to be the way it is. And this is something that we want to ask you, Professor. First, I always start by saying, how are you? How's your family? And I hear Ithaca is gorgeous.
So for those of y'all who don't know, that's like Ithaca's kind of motto is Ithaca's gorgeous, but it's a play on word because it's, you know, we have gorges. It's G-O-R-G-E-S. So speaking of all the gorges that we have and waterfalls. Ithaca is, though, today we have sun, so that's a wonderful thing. No snow since the beginning of May, so it's been almost a month now. You know, I think we can exhale. But me and mine are all so far fine. My son is living in New York, so that's a constant source of worry for me. But by now it's been in the city. He lives in East Harlem. And my mother's out in California. So somehow we all were spread out in COVID hotspots for a time. What were COVID hotspots? But we have come to this point, come this far so we're all grateful for that. Thank you for asking.
You're welcome. And we're listening to this conversation with Professor Noelia Rooks. She's on Twitter at nrooks, R-O-O, no, N-R-O-K-I-E, nrookie on Twitter. Please do follow her. I got to start with your title, Professor. What a legacy to live up to. What a title, what a name, the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature.
Yeah, you know, Du Bois is one of the few scholars for me, or few figures for me, that is intimidating. For those of your listeners who don't know, he has produced work in so many genres. He's written a novel. You know, he's written poetry. I don't really think that poetry is his forte, but he wrote some and he got it published. He is considered the founder of sociology. He's considered a founder of Black Studies, though not all sociology departments give him his props with that, with being the founding father of it. His work at the turn of the 20th century around Black Philadelphia, that was data-driven, where he went and collected data, sent out teams of researchers about Black people in Philadelphia. It's called the Philadelphia Negroes, one of the largest and the first times that we had seen scholarship and work actually based on large data sets, which some acknowledge that is the beginning of sociology, others don't. His work on Black Reconstruction is a work of history, is still a preeminent work. And his dissertation from Harvard is the first Black person to get a PhD from Harvard, was based on the African slave trade, you know, work that is standing the test of time. So it is an honor and a responsibility, I feel like, to live up to. Someone whose scholarship and work and vision was always engaged around people of African descent, even as he did that work in the rarefied air of Ivy League colleges and universities.
And his legacy is so, is so pervasive in so many aspects of America and American higher education. And there are other professors with this title. Do you ever get together, all the Du Bois professors?
No, I never have. I know, no, we've never just sort of kicked it. Most of the folks who I have met who have the title, I met them before I did. So, but it's an honor of the titles that one can have bestowed upon them. It's an honor.
I've seen Kenneth MacLean has that title of emeritus of Du Bois professor, and so many other folks all over the country have that title, and it means a lot. And I wonder do you ever think what he would make of this moment? Did he foresee a time when there would be a Black president? Did he see things getting better for African Americans in the future?
While by the end of his life, let me say, the arc of his scholarship and his work, I think is instructive. There was a period for him earlier on in the 1900s, like 1906 on, 1903 on, where he really was like, you know, the thing that we need to do is explain it to white people in power. But they just don't understand how racism works. They don't understand the what's underlying the brutality that we're seeing rain down on Black communities. They're living in their whole own world, kind of separate from and cut off from a lot of, for many, you know, those in power and with privilege, just don't get to see it. So there's a period of his life up through what I'm saying about the Philadelphia Negro work, where it really was, let me explain it to you. Let me bring the full force of my gift of oratory and thought and passion and persuasion to you so that you can see what needs to be done differently. And he founded organizations, the precursor to the NAACP,
you know, it was this multiracial organization that was sort of like, see, because I know these things, I know that there are white people and black people, if we get together and work on this thing, this oppression, these lynchings, these murders, this disenfranchisement, this disdain, this constant disdain that is dehumanizing, we can change it. And so the period of work that he is most known for really is about that. He does have hope. He's just like, we just need to dig up the information so that you understand what the origins of the African slave trade were, and then you'll see the argument I'm making about how wrong-headed you are in the mistreatment of people of African descent. Or, you know, the period during the World Wars where he would tell black people, the thing to do is fight for America, because if you fight and show your citizenship, if you shed your blood, that will prove to them, that will prove to people in power that we're worthy of acceptance. So there's a break, though. About the time that he renounces his U.S. citizenship and leaves the country, it goes to Ghana. He has, before this period, but by then that's the culmination of him really understanding that it is not a lack of understanding of how systems of oppression work that are leading to global disenfranchisement of people of African descent. It's his understanding that those systems are working exactly the way they're supposed to, and that there's going to have to be a protest and rebellion and a radical black practice that is global, that both brings aid and comfort to people of African descent while it strategizes ways to overthrow and overturn those ideologies that he's seen as most oppressive. So early Du Bois might not necessarily, I'm not sure if he would have been with the, actually early Du Bois probably would have been with the black president. You know, we can do it, we can explain it. Later Du Bois, I think, would have had a critique about what it means to have a black president as the head or the agent of empire, of imperialism, of a government and a system that around the globe is actually implicated in oppressing other folks who have black skin, we who are dark. That's his term that I love. You know, he has this this term instead of saying people of color or what. It's the we who are dark. I don't know why that just hits me in a certain kind of way. So I think he would have really applauded the fact that what we're seeing now, is to the extent that COVID and police brutality, Mr. Floyd's the protests in support of Mr. Floyd and all the others who have been victims of police brutality, he believed that. It was going to take a multiracial group of like-minded folks to rise up where they are and to make demands and make changes. And so that, I think, some of what we're seeing here, at least in the early days, seems to me to be a culmination of some of his dreams.
And it's important to remember that he actually lived a very long life. And so he spanned decades and changes in America. Yeah. He was born just after the Civil War ended and lived till 1963, which tells you he saw much more of America and the changes than many of us who think of him as much more early 20th century alone may have noted.
The March on Washington, you know, the famous I Have a Dream series, most Americans know it as, you know, not the March for Jobs and Justice, but the I Have a Dream speech march. But the announcement was made there. He died on the day that the March on Washington was held. And there was an announcement made at the march that Mr. Du Bois has passed.
Oh, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about that. That's how, right? Just think that that's where it was announced. And this was in the days before, you know, today's kind of mass media and social media and everything else. And that's quite stunning to think about that. Just before we move off this topic, what if you could read one book about Du Bois, what do you recommend?
By or about? There's a new biography about Du Bois that Gerald Horn and Charisse Burden-Stelly have written. It maybe a year old? It may be a year old. It's a stunning biography, so that's worth reading. In terms of what he has written, so the lowest hanging fruit, sort of the most accessible thing, would be his collection, 1906, The Souls of Black Folks, that I think really does. And it's trying to explain the situation of being a Black American from a Black perspective. It's a collection of essays that he had published. I think those stand up well. But to me, the stunning thing that he did is Black Reconstruction. But as this book is 1,000 pages, that's why I don't really think, most people are going to just rush out to read it. But in terms of explaining what a hopeful moment Reconstruction was, that right after the Civil War, there's this, we now know it's a half-hearted commitment to freedom and justice that was easily withdrawn and needed troops and the might of the military to have any hope. However, in that little moment when it existed following the Civil War, before the troops were removed and we got to post-Reconstruction, you had Black people voting, you had a flowering of Black schools that were protected, that could actually function. You had literacy going through the roof. You had people learning new kinds of jobs. Like even though it was a half-hearted kind of commitment to the newly freed, what the newly freed did with it when given just half a chance to be citizens is overwhelming to me in its scope and impact. And so that's that's the thing that I think really captures so much about his brilliance, but also the about the moment in America. But Souls of Black Folk is the easiest.
Yeah, and that's a great book. I read that about 20 years ago. Here is the book that you mentioned, W.E.B. Du Bois, A Life in American History by Charisse Burden-Stelly and Gerald Horn. There's one copy left on Amazon. So somebody who wants it, who doesn't have a Kindle, of course, they can have any number of copies, but there's one copy left at this moment. It's like, go right now and buy that book because Professor Rooks has recommended it.
Check what's happening at your independent bookstore since Amazon is doing okay, but they are not. But yes, in any case, however, whatever you have to do to get it, I would say get it if you're interested in learning more about Mr. Du Bois, Professor Du Bois.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Du Bois's, the way to recommend to your title is Du Bois Professor of Literature at Cornell University. And that's, as I said, an amazing title. Let's move on. We have a caller on WBAI, been very patiently listening to us. You're on the air with Professor Rooks. Please tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, it's Russ up in Westchester again, Sri. Hey, for the first time yesterday, I wore a bandana over my mouth in support of the heroes at the barricades, because I understand that the anonymity is an important part of the social unrest and the social convulsion. I was wrong to buck the tide, but I think a lot of these people are out there because of the government overreach, telling us where we can go, what we can wear, if we can use cash. I think that using stop and mask to empower the police exposes the velvet fist of public health law wrapped in an iron glove of police brutality. But let me make it clear, Sheree, I think those 57 cops in Buffalo who resigned their assignment, they should be fired. They should be fired. So-called police unions should be disbanded. They're managers. They're managing the civilian population. I would like to ask the professor, though, something specifically. If it is what you want, because I believe that the police should be abolished or defunded, and the way to do that is to fire them all, like Reagan did Patco, and rehire with intense psychological review. I'd like to get the answer to that, if you could. Hello?
It's interesting. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Did he disappear?
No, I'm here. I just don't want to say something offensive because I had said something offensive once in the past, so I'm watching what I say.
So it's funny. My husband just said this morning we should fire all the police.
Yeah.
And you know, rehire different ones. Like, it's just interesting to me that I just heard the exact same thing. But I really think that one of the most kind of hopeful, I was saying this when I was on the phone with Jamila, one of the most sort of hopeful developments that I'm seeing right now really has to do with this, the way that the abolish the police or defund the police. Because I think what defunding the police is actually gaining more ground than straight police abolition, although we're hearing more about police abolition than we ever have. And so when you have, I think it was Minnesota that like taking $150 million out of the police budget and giving it to schools. But when you have, and I've seen a couple of other states as well say, well, maybe the police don't really need to buy another tank. You know, perhaps we can instead take that money and use it in ways that are actually going to promote citizenship, to promote belonging, to promote inclusion, and to start with the school. I find that a very, I think that's workable. I think that you can probably actually get some wins there with defund the police, to reapportion that money. And I think the thing is, just to be clear for folks, is that part of the movement really starts to get up and going, to be clear about what are we doing with the money, right? Like, not just we're taking it from the police, but then what do you do that's actually of use? The other thing that's catching fire that I think is a real hopeful kind of moment is people just saying, look, it's not that deep. Say, don't kill people. Like, just tell the police, you know? Don't kill people who are unarmed. Don't kill them. You know, nobody's saying, like, to stand there, somebody's running down on you with a knife or a pistol or a gun or whatever, to just stand there or whatever. But, you know, if you are talking about unarmed citizens laying in their beds, you know, you're called to the scene, but they're unarmed and they're subdued, making it clear that if you kill them, there are consequences. That seems so small. That seems so small. Making the chokehold, right? Just don't do it.
Right.
Don't do
Professor,
it. You know?
Professor, I am confused about one thing. You know, I watch cops and live PD because the interaction of the police is where the government meets civilians. And this is common behavior with the police, white and black. And obviously, this is an uprising against black mistreatment in our society in general, and specifically police abuse. But there are many, many white people out there because they get mistreated by G.I. Joe cops, too. And white people are dying in private spaces. I appreciate the need to stoke racial resentment. And I think the Karen factor, where that woman, you know, pulled that thing with 911, has produced so many white women at the barricades. These are the white people who you say are like shedding blood to prove they are worthy. And so I think we shouldn't separate protesters from rioters. It's a spectrum. These are people who are fighting for all of us. They are warriors. We should thank these people for their service. They're not stealing. They're anti-materialistic. And I think we should be ready for the police to start resigning en masse. We have to have a plan. These police are not going to, you know, keep putting themselves on. What's happening is that in group activities, people lose their anonymity and they do crazy things in union picket lines, in demonstrations, and even when the police, when they're in their big groups with their uniforms, they lose control. So I hope we're ready with a plan, and I have faith that you'll do it. Thank you, Sri, for letting me talk.
Professor, your thoughts?
I think that, like I said, what is hopeful to me about this moment really is that we're seeing people with a number of different kinds of interests, just basic anti-racist interest or, police reform or abolition, or
the financial, you know, but people who have long been questioning our military budgets, the amount of money that is going to fund certain, the choices that we make about what we are going to fund. What we're seeing in the COVID, Black Lives Matter, police murders coalescing, I think are a number of those different groups that are already highly organized, already highly successful, but they're pieces of what they've been working on that are so clearly illustrated. The necessity for the things that they've been working on are so clearly illustrated in this moment where even following Mr. Floyd's murder, being caught, you know, on video, the images that we're seeing of police doing their job with peaceful protesters, it is heightening and reaffirming the need for something concrete to be in place. Like we're seeing entirely too many images of unarmed protesters. People in New York, right, all these people who are just trying to deliver food on their bicycles, they're not even protesting. They just happen to be cutting through a area where there is a protest as they do their delivery job, being yanked off their bike and beaten. You're looking at police wield their batons in places like the South Bronx a couple of nights ago for the past couple of nights. And in Washington, D.C., and all across the country, you're watching them just wield their batons and just start wailing on people who are often running. They are unarmed and they are running. So it's not just the murder that is clearly what has unleashed something. It's also the argument that the police continue to make for how they think they need to do their job. I mean, you have more Americans, more people around the globe, quite frankly, it's not even just Americans, who are saying that makes no sense. We reject that argument. We do not stand with you. And so it's a hopeful moment because you have enough folks saying, yes, but if you're going to have the police, fine. But do they need to just pull out their billy clubs and have at whoever happens to be standing peacefully near them?
And you pointed out, or we talked about earlier, the story of the 75-year-old white man who walks up to a police officer and he's just thrown on the ground. He's lying there bleeding out of his ears. And dozens of cops
people
on camera do nothing. And then when two of the cops are suspended, the police departments, a bunch of them resign, not out of, you know, anger at what's happening with the brutality, but in support of those two police officers. I mean, it's just stunning that this is the situation, and it's hard to grasp. You're obviously out of class now. What would you be saying to your students about this moment in America?
So the policing, I teach a class called Intro to American Studies, and that class is different from others that I teach. It's a lecture class, but it is overwhelmingly filled with people who have never had a class that is delving into these narratives about what America is. I mean, we start with the whole colonization, you know, settler colonial, you know, people who just kind of show up and are like, oh, look, indigenous people, let's enslave them, right? Like that is the beginning of America. And the students in that particular, like a lot of, most of the students who I teach are attracted to the topics, know something about it, are coming because, you know, they've heard something about me as a teacher. Like they're making certain kinds of choices. This one is just a low level intellect. And the things that are amazing to me and have been troubling things I'm thinking about, how little about these kinds of political issues do students who find their way at Cornell, most of whom come from highly competitive public school districts or private schools. It's just a little over half either come from private schools, or if they're public schools, you know, they're really high-performing public schools, how little, what few tools they have to make sense of things like, you know, poverty, brutality, racism, how little it is taught or discussed, or any piece of it is taught or discussed where they are, and how ill-equipped they are to talk about it. It's not that they're bad people and don't care, right? It's just never been a part of what they are taught. So the parts on police brutality or on policing that I do, it actually is a in combination with incarceration, like the carceral state, like talking about how central the police have become in different periods in the United States to the whole idea of the state, of the works of the state. Like they are, if you have some kids who are unruly or not paying attention to their parents or truant, you know, we're at a point where, depending on where you are, it's likely the police will show up and insert themselves into your family, household, and dynamics in ways that will maybe remove a child from the home. You know, like there are different things that can happen. If your loved ones are sick, the sick and frail and shut in, don't answer the phone for a few days, this thing called a wellness check. So you call the police. You ask them to go do a wellness check to check on your aged relative. And we've had a number of cases. We're in the midst of the wellness case where people are calling to check on the welfare of an elderly person. The police have killed them. Right? Like, so the thing about the role of the police, the social, you know, we would normally think that there'd be social structures and a way of dealing with problems in the home or truancy. I mean, why are you truant? Are you homeless? Are you, you know, like what, finding out what the issues are and what kind of support you need societally to make sure that you can send your kid to school, or if you have an elderly, you know, someone's elderly in your home, you would normally think that there are family structures or social structures that could step in and look at them, but the police have become this kind of catch-all. And so when I talk about the police with my students, I mean, in that class, and what I would do would be to look at all of the ways that the police function in American society beyond just this kind of law and order rhetoric that we tend to. They're not just solving crime anymore. They're making judgments. They're So this part of what you see about these people with these 911 calls, right? Like, there's somebody here. I don't want him here. I just don't feel, you know, good about him being here. So I'm going to call 911 to have him removed from the public park. How did it come that we think of the police as this sort of catch-all? So I think those are some of the questions we would be looking at.
Thank you, Professor. I feel like I'm in a class with you, and I'm learning so much. I really appreciate it.
I may be talking too much because I'm used to lecturing. So you had to tell me, like, cut it out.
No, we love hearing that and hearing your thoughts. It's very, very important and very helpful to us. Thank you. I just want to make sure everybody knows about your book that you have written. It's called Cutting School Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. How is it that a city like New York, the largest public school system in America, is so segregated?
Oh, wow. Well, see, you need to, like, have me on for a series of podcasts for that right there. But
Done, Professor. We're booking you for the next month every Saturday, 1 p.m., lessons with Professor Rooks.
Yeah, right? Like, lessons in segregation. Here we go. The basic argument that I put forward and ask people to consider in the book is the ways that segregation is actually quite lucrative in society. So we are always talking about it as if it's just something that just happened. Or sometimes we'll talk about segregation as choice, you know, like black people just want to live with black people. White people just want to live with white people. But we're always wringing our hands to some extent about how intractable it is. Like, we have all manner of stuff that tell you that housing segregation advantages whites and disadvantages black people in urban areas, or that there's a difference between rural and urban, that kind of segregation, which is also often economic and race. We'll say school education, you know, it disadvantages black children and, you know, some will tell you white children as well to have a school system divided the ways that they are in race. But it's almost like, so we have Brown v. Board and we've tried everything and, you know, what are we going to do? So I go back to the beginning of public education or of taxpayer supported compulsory education. That's the post-Civil War is the first time the United States said all citizens are required to have some levels of education, some months of education. It depended wildly, the amount of time differed based on race and region, and that the state is required to collect taxes and pay for it. You know, the education is not mentioned in the Constitution, so the ways that we educate, the ways that we pay for education are state by state for the most part. So what I look at is that though there's never been a period in American history where we have educated black kids and poor children in the same ways that we have wealthy kids. And it is that segregation itself that allows for whites to have better quality schools. It's not just wanting black kids to sit in the room with white kids. It's that segregation and all of the structures that uphold it allow white communities and white school districts to hoard funds. Or if they're pulling from certain neighborhoods, and we know how housing segregation works, then what they're paying in the system in terms of taxes just completely swamps what poor black neighborhoods or even middle class black neighborhoods are able to put in terms of taxes. So it's just unequal. And then you add PTAs. In New York City, you have some PTAs that were contributing up to $1 million a year to the education of their kids. They're hiring extra instructors. They're renovating schools. So segregation, while we keep saying we want to pull it apart, actually benefits powerful interest in all kinds of ways, housing interest, labor interest, and to get the how and the why of how that happens, you will have to buy and read the book. But
yes, Professor, I'm afraid we're out of time, but we will tell everyone, please buy that book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. We'd love to have you back. And we want everyone to follow you at nrookie on Twitter, R-O-O-K-I-E. You're anything but a rookie. But thank you so much, Professor Nolwe Rooks of Cornell, the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature. Thank you very much for everyone for listening. We'll be back next Saturday, noon to 2 p.m. for another edition of Coping with COVID-19. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan. I do other shows every single day on YouTube, youtube.com/Srenet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T. Professor, thank you. We hope you'll come back.
Thank you much. I'm happy to.
Thank you. And we're going to leave you with Could You Be Loved?, the 1980 hit by Bob Marley, a ballad to the poor yet welcoming people Marley met in Brazil. Thanks for listening to our show and supporting WBAI. See you next week, everybody.
Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Hello, my name is Ralph Pointer. I am a member of the WBAI Local Station Board. The next meeting of the Local Station Board will be Wednesday, June 10th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be a remote access meeting, which will be accessible to members of the public. It will include an opportunity for public comment. By phone, if you are in the U.S., dial 929-205-6099. The meeting ID number is WBAILSB995 on a phone keypad. To join online, go to Zoom and put in that same meeting ID. It's easy to remember because it's WBAILSB995. Again, the meeting is Wednesday, June 10th at 7 p.m. And instructions for accessing the meeting, including how to submit public comments, will also be available through WBAI's main webpage.
Nueva York, 2020 es una gran oportunidad para hacer que nuestras voces se oigan. Este año tenemos el poder de determinar el futuro de nuestra ciudad, no solo para los próximos 4 años, sino los próximos 10, a través de ser contado en el censo. El censo se trata del poder del dinero y del respeto para nuestras comunidades. Si nuestra ciudad es subcontada, corremos el riesgo de ser subrepresentados, especialmente en la comunidad de color. En el 2010, solo el 62% de newyorkinos respondieron al censo, con las tasas de respuestas más bajas en comunidades negras y marrones. En 2020 no podemos dejar que esto pase de nuevo. Si quieres resistir este status quo y desafiar la persona en el poder que quieren silenciarnos, empieza por hacerse contado en el censo. El censo es seguro y fácil para todos. Y acuérdate, la pregunta de ciudadanía no aparece en el censo. Inmigrantes documentados o indocumentados también cuenta. Mi gente presente. Visita my2020census.gov ahora y llena las 10 preguntas simples para hacerse contar.
Hello, I'm Isaac Ferguson. I'm inviting you to tune in on Saturday 4 to 6 p.m. for Caribbean Voices and Beyond, when we will bring you news, views, and important issues affecting the Caribbean community in particular and the immigrant community in general. Tune in 4 to 6 p.m. to Caribbean Voices and Beyond on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the Internet.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial and keep on